Another aspect of our interconnectedness with each other, the planet, and all life is electromagnetic. Once thought to be an insignificant epiphenomenon, the noise of the machine, the electromagnetic fields generated by our brains, hearts, organs, and indeed every living cell, are now recognized by a few visionary scientists to carry information to which all life responds. Already, medical pioneers are exploring how to apply this principle to healing through a proliferation of gadgets you can find on the internet, most of them backed only by anecdotal evidence. Given this unexplored realm of electromagnetic communication that interweaves every living cell, the standard control-based response would be, how can we take advantage of this knowledge to exert more powerful, more precise control over reality? In the age of reunion, the response will be to become more attuned to the ocean of being in which we are embedded. From that attunement will arise knowledge, such as that we label intuitive, that would seem supernatural to our present way of thinking. Corresponding to the knowledge will arise undreamed of ways to communicate with each other, with plants, animals, disease organisms, and even our own organs, tissues, and cells. Technologies are already emerging that amplify or clarify this communication. Among them are the Feldenkrais method, EFT, spinal network analysis, applied kinesiology, and numerous energy modalities. While scientific orthodoxy generally rejects the conclusions I've shared above, they are at least plausible in the sense that they appeal to known physical forces. A responsible scientist might say, well, it could be true, but I doubt that it is. Irresponsible conjecture, but at least possible. Unfortunately, known physical forces apparently cannot account for all the phenomena that are observed in alternative medicine, psi, qigong, and many other fields. For example, effects that might be explained in terms of electromagnetic frequencies often do not obey the inverse square rule. Others apparently violate causality by projecting effects backward in time. I propose that the mechanisms of water structure, electromagnetism, DNA, and so forth described above are just a few of the manifestations of a fundamental principle of interconnectedness or holism that will be the organizing principle of future technology. With the demise of Cartesian objectivity, the intrinsic inseparability of observer and observed has suggested the possibility of influencing reality through focused belief and intention. Experiments at the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Lab, PEAR, have shown, over millions of trials, a statistically significant observer effect on supposedly random quantum events. Other experiments, pioneered by Helmut Schmidt, seem to show that this effect can extend backwards in time to affect pre-recorded data. The HeartMath Institute has performed experiments documenting a measurable emotional response to disturbing photos randomly placed among a series of banal photographs several seconds before the photograph is actually viewed. Clive Baxter has spent decades investigating how plants exhibit a galvanic response not only to damage to nearby plants, but even to the intention of doing such damage. Then, of course, there are the numerous studies of the effects of prayer on healing, including double-blinded studies published in top medical journals. These are but the tip of the iceberg in the world of anomalies research, which I mention here only to suggest a possibility, not to convince you that it is real. I leave that to others. In the interests of honest disclosure, I believe it is real. With a caveat, however, what does real mean? It is very difficult to define real apart from the objective reality out there of the Newtonian world machine. In fact, all the phenomena I've touched upon in this chapter, and many I have not discussed, are notoriously elusive in the laboratory. The more rigorous the controls, the less visible the phenomenon, inviting the conclusion that they are but artifacts of sloppy procedure. The most dramatic effects are anecdotal and impossible to verify. Experimental results are often not reproducible. The conventional wisdom of thousands of practitioners merges into the placebo effect in the strictest of double-blind studies. This elusiveness is a central feature of the phenomena and key to understanding them. For now, just ponder what real might mean in a world that is not objective, where something can happen for me and not for you, where there is no absolute universal Cartesian coordinate system that is the stage for reality. I mean it. Put down this book for a moment and ponder what real could mean without an objective backdrop. I've been thinking about this almost daily for 10 years now, and the concept still gives me vertigo. Curiously, a similar elusiveness has plagued other controversial areas of science, such as cold fusion. In this case, the original researchers, Fleischmann and Pons, announced a dramatic result which other scientists were unable to replicate. Or were they? Many actually did get results, others did not. But did the latter follow the original protocol exactly? Some of the laboratories that failed to replicate Pons and Fleischmann's findings had a vested interest in rejecting them. Many were part of the hot fusion research establishment. Particularly egregious was the definitive MIT rejection of cold fusion when their attempt to replicate the experiment failed to produce the levels of neutrons that conventional theory predicts. It couldn't be happening, they concluded. Only later did it emerge that the MIT experiment actually did produce anomalous heat. The controversy still simmers today, with the general consensus being that the phenomenon is an artifact or a fluke. Much of this comes down to the old standby. It isn't true because it couldn't be true. There is no known mechanism to explain it. However, a third possibility exists. Perhaps cold fusion only works in an appropriate atmosphere of belief and only works regularly and generally if that atmosphere of belief pertains to the society as a whole. Perhaps we must understand cold fusion, too, as a technology of mind as well as a technology of matter. Technotopians fondly dream of a new source of clean, cheap, limitless energy. Then all our problems would be solved. But perhaps we can only tap into those sources when we have let go of the ideologies of separation that cut us off from the plenitude of the universe. Perhaps our mentality of lack, want, and scarcity necessarily projects onto our energy technology, and true abundance cannot come until we cease trying to enclose reality into a private human realm of ownership and control. In other words, limitless energy sources will come when we are ready for them, even if individual researchers in cold fusion and many other infinite energy fields are getting positive results. An ideological force thwarts their broad application. This will not change until our fundamental worldview, the mentality of scarcity and separation, changes. I, for one, am glad we don't have infinite energy yet. Well, actually, we do. Even if cold fusion, zero-point energy, hydrino energy, and all the other infinite technologies are fantasies, the current mounting energy shortage is still the indirect result of our mentality of scarcity. Our universe is awash in limitless energy. Imagine that all the money spent on oil wars in the last half century had gone toward developing wind, solar, tidal, and geothermal power. Imagine that we had a financial system that encouraged the capitalization of future energy savings. We already have the technology of energy abundance. Most of the uses to which fossil fuel energy is put to do little to contribute to human happiness. What proportion is devoted to the manufacture of armaments and the conducting of wars? to shoddy consumer goods that quickly end up in landfills, to energy-hungry McMansions in which people are isolated, lonely, and miserable, to running the car-dependent infrastructure of suburbia in which people are no happier than in compact villages served by bicycle and rail. The green technologies mentioned earlier in this chapter do not detract from our quality of life, and they needn't await some magical new invention. Yet just as with the more magical infinite energy technologies, it is our beliefs that keep their abundance at a distance. At bottom, it is our fundamental belief in the discrete self, separate from nature and from each other, that generates the war, the economic system, the acquisitiveness that consumes the vast part of our energy cornucopia. Many of the ways that beliefs affect reality are quite mundane. The technologies of mind suggested above come at a price, the loss of certainty. However powerful they are, they cannot be used to impose control over an external universe. Imagine it were all true, that the human mind can in fact bend spoons and maybe much more, that people can learn to levitate or be at two places at once, and that cancerous tumors can melt away like snowballs on a hot stove, that people can materialize objects at will or see into the human body to diagnose disease. And imagine that the scattered stories of such events point only to a tiny fragment of our true potential. A future where the technologies of fire have retreated to their proper place need not be stagnant or dull. But when such technology is possible only through intention and belief, then we must let go of the ideology of the rational observer who sits back and makes observations on which to base beliefs. I mentioned in Chapter 6 the idea that it is beliefs that determine observations and not vice versa, as we suppose. If that becomes the foundation of a new science, then the technology arising from that science must also abandon the very same certainty. In place of certainty, we will have self-exploration, an awareness of choice, and a sense of empowering creativity. Realizing the illusory nature of the self-not-self distinction, the falsity of an independently existing universe out there, we will abandon the futile program to force life into a mold of security and ease that is at odds with the deep anxiety and insecurity which gives the program a rise. As we step more and more into the realization of our connectedness, our actions will reinforce that connectedness and bring it even further into our experience. Reality will become more malleable to our beliefs, assuming more of a fluid, dreamlike quality. Paradoxically, by releasing the mentality of control, certainty, and proof, we will exercise far greater power to determine our experience of reality, choosing what we shall experience, rather than impotently struggling against what we have unconsciously chosen. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. Work and art united. Work is a defining feature of modern life. When we ask someone, "What do you do?" we typically mean, "What is your work?" And by that we mean, "What do you do for money?" And work, a defining feature of life, is itself associated with drudgery, tedium, sacrifice, and routine, the daily grind. These features are characteristic of the machine, and it is no wonder, immersed as we are in a machine civilization, that we view work in contradistinction to leisure and to fun. The demise of the mechanical view of the universe and the end of the machine civilization holds a new promise, not for the obsolescence of work, but for its transformation. Work in a post-machine age, in an ecological economy, will take on a new character. And I might add, it is beyond time for that. This transformation will go beyond the content and nature of work itself to revolutionize the economic relationship of, quote, employment. Work and leisure, job and life will become one. For several hundred years, machines have been replacing human beings for rote, laborious tasks. Paradoxically, most human occupations are still tedious and routine. That is because even as machines have taken over more and more functions, new functions have been born of the expanding mega machine, whose human parts, no less than its inanimate parts, must fulfill the machine's requirement of standardization. The very effort to eliminate labor demands more labor than it eliminates, because the effort is itself an intensification of machine methodology. Again, the master's tools can never dismantle the master's house. The transformation of work is coming in a different way than two centuries of futurists have envisioned. Not because all routine functions have been once and for all automated, but because society will require fewer and fewer such functions. One consequence of local currencies and green technologies will be a decrease in scale in many industries. Today, many mass production processes are only more efficient because they externalize costs. Agriculture is a prime example. Factory farming is more efficient in terms of labor hours, but far less efficient in terms of energy use or pollution production than organic agriculture. When costs are internalized, many industrial practices will give way to more labor-intensive methods. In many areas, mass production will become obsolete, and along with it, the archetype of the assembly line, in which work is routine, repetitive, and highly fragmented, requiring little skill, little personal contact, and many layers of hierarchical management. These characteristics stand in contrast to repair work, which is local, small-scale, highly skilled, personal, and tangible in its results. The economic logic that today makes it cheaper to buy a new stereo rather than repair an old one will be reversed as raw materials come to reflect their true costs and as designers begin to design for durability and ease of repair. And I would like to interject that the only reason they don't is because of capitalism. It is because of the economic system and the need for perpetual growth and perpetual sales and increased consumption. Continuing. The result will be more labor-intensive. Repairs do require significant labor, but the nature of the labor will be vastly different, as will the economic model it entails. Another impetus toward the passing of the factory system, and along with it the whole psychology of the Mumfordian mega-machine, is the increasingly unmanageable complexity of engineering processes and business administration. Unmanageable, that is, according to the reductionist paradigm of management. The resulting transformation in business, already visible in the flattening of corporate hierarchies, is not some trendy new business fad, but a practical necessity, a consequence of the breakdown of design processes under the weight of their own management. Increasingly, today's complex processes are impervious to traditional cut-and-control engineering, in which the problem is broken down into parts, subparts, and so forth, mirroring the traditional business hierarchy. Whether in business or engineering, the old approach to problem-solving, break it down and treat each piece separately, is no longer working very well. In any machine, whether made of human or inanimate parts, The complexity of relationships among parts increases exponentially with their number. The proliferation of variables quickly gets out of control, and at some point, traditional reductionistic solutions must give way to solutions that are grown, not engineered. This is already happening in many fields, such as circuit design, where evolutionary algorithms search for solutions inaccessible to analytic methods. Software engineering is another example in which the product's complexity defies hierarchical management. Increasingly, solutions grow from the ground up among legions of independent programmers. Visionary thinkers such as Michael Bowens have generalized the peer-to-peer revolution in the field of information technology as a new model of economic, social, and political organization. Peer-to-peer networks bear a striking resemblance to the gift economies of ancient times, as well as to the characteristics of a demurrage-based economy. As in a potlatch society, status in such a community comes from how much one contributes, not from how much one owns. Resources are shared generally, not hoarded, and the exchange of goods occurs on a gift basis. Such networks have produced new models of journalism, the blogosphere, that compiles, filters, edits, and organizes enormous quantities of information far more efficiently than traditional news organizations can. Other structures with peer-to-peer elements include the Wikipedia and the structure growing up around Amazon.com, eBay, and Google. All of them profit by giving information away for free. One by one, the information providers who cling to the business model of amassing and selling vast quantities of proprietary information have fallen by the wayside. The Encyclopedia Britannica is an example. Others in the music, film, and software industries are still struggling to hold on to the information equals property model. Farther out on the margins, a huge shadow economy thrives that is even more explicitly gift-based. The people who participate in file-sharing networks trust fully in the spirit of the gift when they put their music collection or software cracks online for anyone to download. In some of these subcultures, it is considered gauche to ever demand money for data. The concept of profiting by giving it away is part of a larger shift in the nature of work. Instead of working for money, money becomes a side effect of doing good work. No longer slave to money, work serves other goals: beauty, service, fun, or self-expression. The worker, in other words, becomes an artist. This is also a consequence of a very different relationship to material objects that will develop in a restorative economy. Oh God, I've dreamed all my life of living in such a society. Because of the internalization of costs, the mounds of plastic junk we buy today will be far more expensive, so much so that there will no longer be mounds of plastic junk. Consumer goods in general won't be so cheap anymore, and I mean that in both senses of the word cheap. We consider ourselves to be the wealthiest society in history, but lives full of vast quantities of cheap stuff are themselves poor and cheap. To live among objects that are not cheap, but made with consummate skill, attention, and care would be true material wealth. Can you imagine a society where each person's talents and gifts were fully expressed in their work and not suppressed in the interests of machine life? And I will interject, yes, anarchists can, and that's why we're anarchists. Can you imagine a home in which every appliance, garment, and piece of furniture was so wisely designed, so well made, so elegant a marriage of beauty and function that no one would ever miss throwaway things too cheap to really care about? Life will abound with beautifully made objects, because in the restorative economy, all of us will be craftspeople, expressing our full talents in work rather than denying them for the sake of keeping a job. Part of this will be a dramatic revival of traditional handcrafts as, quote, natural resources will have become so precious as to merit the best individual workmanship. But even in the high-tech sector, the number of narrowly specialized work functions will be far less than it is today, and each person will consider him or herself an artist. The restorative economy will thus demolish some of our culture's basic dualisms: work and art, work and leisure, utility and beauty. When this happens, the noble ideal at the heart of our dreams of technological utopia will come to fruition, not in the obsolescence of work, but in the realization of its true nature. When work is seen from the perspective of Mumfordian machine civilization, then it is inescapably narrow and oppressive. That is why the technotopian dreamers look to the end of labor, each man a king served by machine slaves. Bound by their preconceptions of the nature of work, they could imagine no better than that. But to reunite work and art, to heal the split between work and the rest of life, from which arises the sell-off of our time, is a much more radical ambition. It is an insult to our dignity to live off the produce of anyone doing demeaning work because she has to in order to survive. Work done under compulsion is slave work. Let me repeat that. Work done under compulsion is slave work. A truly wealthy person has no need for such things. Can we envision a life whose objects were all made by people at their best? From the egalitarian societies of the Paleolithic, humanity evolved into great agrarian civilizations in which the rich were those who owned slaves. In the machine age, overt slavery disappeared, only to be replaced with a system in which nearly everyone did demeaning work out of survival anxiety. Do it or you will die. That's slavery, all right. The great promise of machine technology, every man a king, every man a god, has borne its opposite. Every man a slave. Slaves without human owners, all laboring under the yoke of money. But now, with the end of the age of the machine, we see the possibility of a return to the original egalitarianism, in which the economy is a flow of gifts within the context of abundance. If there are still career counselors in the age of reunion, they will help us answer the questions. Which of my creative talents do I enjoy most? Which of the arts would I like to pursue? No longer will work and art be at odds, but one and the same. The reunion of work and art accompanies a new kind of materialism. There is a virtue and pleasure in taking good care of one's things. Before the days of material surfeit and the flood of cheap stuff, people did just that. As recently as the 1930s, people treasured articles like hand tools, fishing rods, tricycles, and children's toys, which received the care needed to last a lifetime, even generations. Today, why bother? Why spend such time and effort on something cheap? A new one only costs $20. Like TV repairs, caring for our things has become economically inefficient. From one perspective, this is a convenience, as we are freed from the burden of having to take care of our things. From the perspective of Chapter 4, it is slavery. Economic exigencies, the exchange of time for money, have rendered us unable to afford the virtue and pleasure of taking care of things. Today's flood of cheapness saves time but cheapens life. By undoing the conversion of life into money, the restorative economy will free us again to love our things and will provide us things worth loving. I am not proposing a disassociation from the material world or the phony spirituality of overcoming the world and the flesh for the sake of some separate Cartesian soul. To the contrary, I envision a future where we love our material possessions more and not less, so that we care where they come from and whence they go. I envision a future in which we see life in the material world as an opportunity to participate in its constant generation of beauty. More than just a consequence of our economic system, the cheapness of modern life is a reflection of the devaluing of materiality implicit in the Cartesian abstraction of spirit away from matter. Who cares about the material world when it is separate from our spiritual selves? The collapse of the Newtonian world machine will reunite us with the world, and we shall once again fall in love with it. To be in love is to dissolve boundaries, to expand oneself to include another. Already it is happening. Have you noticed? One by one, we are rejecting our society's priorities and falling in love again with life. That is our true nature, which we can deny only with increasing effort. It is our nature to love life in both senses of the word, biological life and our personal lives, to love the world and to love our time in it. We have long been frightened into rejecting both, accepting as a result their plunder, the reduction of the living world into resources, things, money, and the reduction of our time into commodified hours, jobs, the grim necessity of making a living. The good news is when we let go of separation and thus fall in love again with life, these results will also give way to their opposites. For the world and for ourselves, we will accept nothing less than lives devoted ardently to creating beautiful things, beautiful music, beautiful ideas. Could you or I comprehend, even for a moment, how fiercely my great-granddaughter and her friends loved being alive, and that this love was not an evanescent mood, but a never-ending power which pervaded every sleeping and waking moment of their lives. Close quote. I do not deny that there may always be dishes to wash, toilets to clean, buildings to roof, tasks that we consider mindless, laborious, or repulsive. But what is wrong with exerting bodily effort in order to maintain life? Shall we invent chewing machines to save us the labor of chewing our own food? Is the goal of humanity's ascent to rest forever in bed, hooked up to various machines that provide us nourishment, pleasure, and excitement without our own effort? That would be the consummation of the machine's promise, wouldn't it? A servant that not only does all our work for us, but lives our lives on our behalf as well. No, the movements of being alive need not be laborious. What makes work laborious is the sacrifice of variety for the efficiency of repetition and standardization. Herein lies the difference between farming and gardening. The former has been the epitome of drudgery. The latter is such a joy that people do it in spite of its economic irrationality. The more a farm resembles a factory and less a garden, the more tedious and life-denying farm work is. Conventional agriculture works according to the same principles as any other industrial enterprise. In a garden, no one spends weeks picking cotton, tomatoes, or grapes. On a small mixed farm, no one spends weeks, months, or years performing over and over again one step in the process of butchering chickens. What makes a task oppressive is not its content, but its duration, motivation, and purpose. Cleaning one's own toilet is neither demeaning nor particularly laborious, quite different from cleaning hundreds of toilets all day for strangers. No one was born onto this earth to clean toilets, and no one would submit to such a life who were not broken or coerced by threat to survival. In a society where work is art and money is not scarce, people will be unwilling to sell their time, their dignity, or their integrity for money. Not only assembly line work and menial labor, but any work that is degrading or life-denying will need to be engineered out. of the economy. How often today do industrial design specifications include such a requirement? The age of reunion is not a return to the past or an abandonment of technology. Rather, it is the motivation and organizing principle of technology that will change. When the psychological and economic forces driving the conversion of life into money are reversed, then technology will no longer seek to make that conversion faster and more efficient. The engineers of the future will design for sustainability, for dignity, and for beauty. They will, in other words, be artists, creating technologies for a world of artists on a garden earth. The conflict that all artists encounter between creating for the market and creating for the spirit will cease when work and art, money and sustainability come into alignment. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. Back to play. Many teachers think of children as immature adults. It might lead to better and more respectful teaching if we thought of adults as atrophied children. Keith Johnstone. Early in the Industrial Revolution, modern schooling was invented in order to acclimate children to work that was tedious, repetitive, degrading, and unfulfilling. The transformation of work into art, therefore, coincides with a parallel transformation in education that will prepare children for lives as artists. In the Currency of Cooperation section, I wrote, "Work will no longer be bound to the search for money, but will seek out ways to best serve each other and the world, each according to our unique gifts and temperament," close quote. In this context, education will be transformed from a preparation to earn a living into a process of self-discovery. It will seek to help each of us to answer the question, what do I love to do? What are my unique gifts? How might I serve others and participate in the creation of a more beautiful world? That these ideals exist already, both in education and in work, points to our intuitive realization of their validity and the unquenchable longing for a world better than the one we experience today. We know deep down that is what education should be. Educators give lip service to these ideas of self-discovery, but in practice, the imperative of control militates against their true expression. In parallel to the financial crisis that will clear the way for a new system of money and the ecological crisis that will spur the adoption of a new system of industry, an educational crisis is crashing down on us that threatens to obliterate the school system as we know it. Already the schools are hemorrhaging teaching talent, legitimacy, and students as classroom violence escalates and literacy rates plummet. The response, typically, is ever more control, more standardized testing for students, more stringent certifications for teachers, more armed guards, metal detectors, locker searches, and razor wire for the school buildings. Successful models of schooling exist that rely on the release of control and not its intensification. Their starting point is a faith in the innate curiosity and creativity of the human being. Man by nature desires to learn, wrote Aristotle. As a child's enormous capacity for uncoerced learning before schooling starts demonstrates. Educational philosophers in the Montessori and Waldorf movements have built entire pedagogies around providing resources to meet children's natural curiosity and desire to grow at each stage of development. Their alternatives to coercion, born of trust in the innate curiosity, intelligence, motivation, and wisdom of the human being, go against the institutional requirements of machine civilization and the ideology of conquering human nature. A beautiful, unadulterated example of the alternative to control-based education is the Sudbury Valley School of Massachusetts, which takes the principle of trusting the child beyond even Waldorf or Montessori. This is a school with no curriculum, no tests, no grades, and no rules, except those legislated by the students themselves. One of the founders writes, quote, "We wanted students to be entirely free to choose their own materials and books and teachers. We felt that the only learning that ever counts in life happens when the learners have thrown themselves into a subject on their own, without coaxing or bribing or pressure. In order to be true to ourselves, we had to get away from any notion of a school-inspired program. We had to let all drive come from the students, with the school committed only to responding to this drive." Close quote. For example, at Sudbury Valley, not one child has ever been forced, pushed, urged, or cajoled, or bribed into learning how to read. And significantly, quote, "We have no dyslexia. None of our graduates are real or functional illiterates." Close quote. Close quote. Despite a lack of any external coercive mechanism or external incentive, Sudbury children display an amazing level of achievement, though not necessarily in traditional academic subjects. Even in the traditional subjects, though, they usually cover the bases, simply because traditional subjects are actually quite simple. One anecdote about the school describes how a self-motivated group of 9 to 12-year-olds learned the entire arithmetic curriculum from 1st to 6th grade in 20 contact hours. An outside educational expert was not surprised. Quote, "Everyone knows that the subject matter itself isn't that hard. What's hard, virtually impossible, is beating it into the heads of youngsters who hate every step. The only way we have a ghost of a chance is to hammer away at the stuff bit by bit every day for years. Even then, it does not work. Most of the sixth graders are mathematical illiterates. Give me a kid who wants to learn the stuff. Well, 20 hours or so makes sense." Close quote. Even more counterintuitive to the intuitions of separation, then self-motivated learning is a complete self-governance of the student body. The school assembly, in which every student age 5 to 18 and every staff member gets one vote, makes all the rules and important decisions for the school, in sharp contrast to my own high school voting system, in which we were allowed to choose the school mascot and the homecoming queen. At Sudbury, the students have real power. They decide on the disposition of funds, the hiring and firing of teachers, and on rules and penalties for infractions. Rule breakers are subject to a court system staffed by students. Distrustful of human nature, we imagine such a system could never work. But for most accounts, it works beautifully. Sometimes the assembly makes mistakes, of course. At the Circle School, a democratic school in Pennsylvania that my children attend, the assembly once voted to abolish chores. The teachers voted against this proposal but were outnumbered. So there were no chores for 2 weeks when the assembly reversed its decisions. The students had learned through experience the necessity of chores, very different than the usual model where the reason for doing chores is because you have to. They learn self-trust rather than obedience to authority, a model that only makes sense if you believe the self is to be trusted. The Sudbury model embodies radical assumptions about human nature and our understanding of self. The school has pioneered a vision of what school will be like in the age of reunion, when the present effort to hold together the illusion of the discrete and separate self finally becomes unbearable and collapses. Until that happens, schools like Sudbury Valley, in parallel with Let's Currencies and Energy Healing, can occupy only a marginal place in our society because they conflict with the dominant institutionalized worldview. Nonetheless, they are extremely important because they provide models which we will naturally and thankfully adopt as we rebuild a society after the convergence of crises. If they are never forced, pushed, cajoled, or bribed into doing anything, what do the students at Sudbury Valley do? So used are we to lives guided by internalized coercion that we imagine, in the absence of self-control, a life of laziness, indulgence, and sloth. When I ask my students what would happen if they lost all willpower, they usually say they would stay in bed until noon, lounge around all day in front of the TV, indulging in the nearest pleasures and conveniences, and after that, a vague, never-ending spiral of indulgence, indolence, and apathy. But this is really just a rebellion against work, when that term is defined, as it has been since the Industrial Revolution, if not before, as something unpleasant, degrading, or laborious that we are forced to do in order to survive. It is not human nature. Sloth and indulgence are not human nature. What is human nature? We can see it at Sudbury Valley. Because what it is that children do in the absence of coercion is, quite simply, to play. And here we come up against one of our culture's defining dualities, the distinction between work and play. The last section of Chapter 2, The Playful Universe, describes how play, purely for play's sake, is seen as a waste of time, a view based on the purpose of life is to survive assumption that underlies modern science and economics. After all, every minute spent playing is a lost opportunity to get ahead in life. However, far from being frivolous or silly, play at school is serious business. Play is always serious for kids, as well as for adults who have not forgotten how. Play is nothing less, in fact, than a child's version of what adult life should be as well. Its value is not in the motor skills or problem-solving techniques it develops. What is learned is the ability to concentrate and focus attention unsparingly on the task at hand, without regard for limitations. No tiredness, no rushing, no need to abandon a hot idea in the middle to go on to something else. Close quote. Play is untrammeled creativity that comes from within. In adult life, play has vanished under the relentless regime of shoulds that prevent us from fully devoting ourselves to anything without regard for limitations. These shoulds are the limitations, schedules, pressure, guilt, survival anxiety. We are usually looking over our shoulder. We experience the concentration and unsparing focus of play as a feeling of timelessness. Joseph Chilton Pierce calls this state entrainment, in which our ability to learn and create are at a maximum. Ironically, the coded threats through which we motivate learning actually create a psychological state inimical to learning. The timelessness of play is almost impossible to reconcile with the busy, scheduled life of the modern adult or school child. As explained in Chapter 2, primitive societies were timeless societies. Hours and minutes, times and dates, clocks and schedules only arose with a complex coordination of human activity necessitated by the division of labor in the machine. A life at play is a timeless life. Here is a passage from Free at Last that I offer you just because it brings tears to my eyes, so enormous the crime it reveals that our civilization has committed against the human spirit, and so simple is its implied prescription. Quote, school opens at 8:30 in the morning and closes at 5 in the afternoon. It isn't unusual to see someone going into the dark room at 9 o'clock, lose track of time, and emerge at 4 o'clock when the work is done. Jacob seats himself before the potter's wheel. He is 13 years old. It is 10:30 a.m. He gets ready and starts throwing pots. An hour passes, 2 hours. Activities swirl around him. His friends start a game of soccer without him. 3 hours. At 2:15, he rises from the wheel. Today he has nothing to show for his efforts. Not a single pot satisfies him. Next day he tries again. This time he rises at 1 o'clock after finishing 3 specimens he likes. Thomas and Nathan, aged 11, begin a game of Dungeons and Dragons at 9. It isn't over by 5, nor by 5 the next day. On the third day, they wrap it up at 2 o'clock. Shirley, 9, curls up in a chair and starts to read a book. She continues at home, and the next 3 days until it is finished. 6-year-old Cindy and Sharon take off for a walk in the woods. It's a lovely spring day. They are out for 4 hours. Dan casts his first line into the pond early on fall morning. 3 years later, he is still fishing. Close quote. Can you recognize this as a model for the lives we are meant to live? To choose our activities and devote ourselves to them fully until we are satisfied with the results? To be free of any schedule requirements but our own? So it is in our culture's most powerful archetype of creativity, the biblical Genesis, when after creating the world, God said, "It is good." Today, instead, we settle not for good, but good enough. Good enough for the grade, the boss, the market, and in doing so, deny the creative purpose for which we are here. But like Jacob, age 13, something in us desires to create beauty free from these limitations, to immerse ourselves in a creative task for its own sake, for as long as it takes, so that in the end we might look upon it with satisfaction and say, "It is good." Daniel Greenberg writes, "Time is not a commodity at Sudbury Valley. It is not used, either poorly or well. It is not wasted or saved. The respect the school shows to private rhythms is inviolate. The children there offer us a model, not only for education but for life, that subverts cultural assumptions so deeply rooted that we are hardly aware of them. To no longer think of time as something to use, waste, or save, that would be a revolution far, far more profound than anything Karl Marx dreamed of. I have gone into such depth about the Sudbury Valley School because it offers a model for bringing us back to play. And coming back to play is the key to overcoming the hegemony of measured time that has bound us tighter and tighter for thousands of years. Since early childhood, few of us have ever experienced a timeless life, except in brief stolen snatches. We adults have relegated much of our play and creativity to the margins, weekend hobbies irrelevant to our livelihoods, just as ordinary school students must sneak in between periods or behind the teacher's back. I do not advocate a return to Stone Age technology as the only means of undoing the bitter consequences of machine ideology. While the outward forms of technology, money, medicine, and education will certainly change, they will do so as a result of a new relationship to the universe that is best summarized, perhaps, as playful. Not only is play timeless, not only is it free of the coercive mechanisms that create ugliness as the price of survival, but it also undoes the artificial self-other distinction that defines the age of separation. In the entrainment state of play, a sense of separate self vanishes as the task at hand absorbs us. Instead of a discrete subject manipulating the universe, we become an organic agent of the universe's own creative process. Through us, the universe creates itself. The same goes for another kind of play that instead of creative might be called exploratory. We play with our boundaries, explore our limits, define who we are. The archetype of this kind of play might be the infant playing with her toes, her hands, her voice, as she learns to coordinate movement, sense, organs, and speech. She is not merely discovering a pre-existing reality of her body. Her explorations are what stimulates her body's development. In all its aspects, true play is inherently and unavoidably creative. The Age of Reunion, will be an age of play that will redefine every human endeavor, not just education, but also work, art, and science. Like an infant playing with yet simultaneously creating her body, science will no longer assume an independently existing reality out there awaiting discovery. What if the scientific method, based on Newtonian assumptions of determinism and objectivity, articulated by Bacon as a means of interrogating nature and extracting her secrets, the scientific method also embodies an intellectual humility, the flip side of its dispassionate objectivity. It represents an intention to hold lightly to preconceived beliefs, hypotheses, to hold lightly onto the existing understanding of the world and our relation to the world, which is really what an experiment is, an exploratory way of relating to the world. The scientific method will still be part of future science, but it will be conceived in the spirit of play. Experiment, which is nothing other than the spirit of let's see what happens if, will be a way of playing with nature, not torturing her as Bacon described. We will test hypotheses not only by how they affect the world, but by how they affect us. We will seek not to control nature, but to find our place within it. Nature will be our teacher, not the object of our domination. For we will realize that its beauty and complex wholeness is beyond our rational, reductionistic, and hence control-enabling understanding. Like the body an infant discovers and develops, our place in nature is neither static nor limiting, but always unfolding, both discovered and created through our play. The model of science along the lines of exploratory play is consistent with the ecological conception of progress and purpose, in that it seeks to fulfill a role that arises beyond ourselves as separate beings. As such, it is much akin to prehistoric ritual, which we, projecting our own ideology, see as an impotent attempt to control nature, bring luck in the hunt, for example, but which actually sought to restore the Earth's balance, to compensate for the damage caused by human beings' already incipient separation from nature. One aspect of the Age of Reunion, then, will be the fusion of science and religion so long sundered. Already we see the portents in the growing mystical metaphors arising from quantum mechanics, the realization of an organic intelligence pervading nature, and the spiritual awakening that invariably accompanies an ecological understanding of nature. With the crumbling of objectivity, the divide that separates experiment and ritual will crumble as well, for both will seek the same goal, to discover and enact our role and function in the dynamic balance of nature. The gathering convergence of crises is bringing the age of separation to an end, and with it everything that we know as civilization. Yet the end of civilization as we know it need not be a return to the past. We equate the ascent of humanity with an escalating domination of nature only because we deny the universe's inherent creative energy, sacredness, and purpose. When we realize that nature itself is dynamic, creative, and growing, then we will no longer need to transcend it, but simply participate in it more fully. And I've been reading from The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of Crises That's Birthing the Transition by Charles Eisenstein, published in 2006. I'll continue next week, but in the meantime, you can read ahead or download all of this book and make others aware of it, as well as Eisenstein's other work. There's quite a bit on his site at ascentofhumanity.com. And you can download a copy in MP3 of this and previous episodes of the show at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.